I really have hope, and I hope that one day, and even today that I hear there is peace, that I can be convinced that there is enough peace, I can go back.
Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Sharimpa in Nyakivari Camp in Western Uganda.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Producers are Kata Mesta, Simba Russo, and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Randy Zimmerman. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. Technical producers are
Jeff. Okay, there's a lot of people involved in this program, but it's 2 minutes late, so we're just going to have to imagine their names. It's 7:02, time for Off the Hook. Good evening, everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you for the next 2 hours tonight. That's right. You heard correctly. This is a special extended program because the personal computer people will not be here tonight at 8 o'clock, sorry to say. If you're tuning in for a special on freedom in Haiti, that's going to be broadcast at a future date on a tape, I believe. We're here for a couple of hours tonight. We have a special program for you, and we have a full house as well. Boy, everyone's here tonight. Let's see if I get everybody right. Red Hack is over there in the corner because he got here late and there's no chairs.
Right.
Okay. And Jeff, you're in your appointed seat.
I'm on time.
Mike, you're here.
Yeah.
And Jim?
I got here early but got bumped over.
All right. And Jim, Lynn is here. Jim and Lynn is here. How you doing?
Good.
And we have a special guest tonight, Adrian Lamo, who is being sentenced tomorrow in federal court, right, in New York City?
Indeed.
We're going to talk about that, and of course we'll have an opportunity for listeners to call in and talk to us all about that particular case and what's going on. It's Off the Hook. Oh, and of course I forgot Bernie S. down there in Philadelphia.
Yes, I'm here too.
How you doing?
Great. It should be a good show, 2 hours long.
2 hours long. I hope your Sprint PCS phone can handle all that bandwidth.
I have an extended battery in, so...
All right, good for you. Bernie, we've had some interesting developments in the last week concerning the ACLU and that terrorist profiling list. What do you know about that?
Well, this is really the first lawsuit filed against the Transportation Security Administration for the unconstitutional nature of this Do Not Fly list. As people, our listeners probably aware, all kinds of people have been prevented from flying or delayed from flying, so they missed their flight, just because they have a name that's identical to or similar to someone on a secret list of suspicious people who could have something to do with terrorism. So even if you have a common name, if someone else is on the list that's a suspected terrorist that also has that name, you get stopped. It doesn't matter if you have all kinds of documentation with you, your passport, your letters from the attorney general. It doesn't matter what documentation you have. You're going to get delayed. You're going to miss your flight at best, and worse, just not allowed to fly. And this is really unconstitutional because the Constitution says people have a right to travel. In so many words. So,
I understand that, the right to travel and all that kind of thing, but does the Constitution say you have the right to travel via airlines?
That's a good question. And it hasn't been settled. It's kind of like kind of like the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. Does it mean you're allowed to have a machine
gun? Yeah, let's get into that discussion.
I don't want to go into that. I'm just saying, you know, there's a lot of ambiguity in the law, and a lot of people tend to think the law is black and white. It says this or that. It's not that way. It's open to interpretation. There's all kinds of, lots of laws, legal decisions are based on case law, you know, what, previous legal decisions, and there is no case law for this transportation, do not fly list thing. So this is the first case, and whatever happens in this case is going to be very significant because it will affect all cases that come after it.
Fascinating. And, of course, we'll be watching this. This was filed, was it yesterday?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll certainly be following that. The air travel system is a mess. All kinds of horror stories. In fact, I'm trying to track one down right now. Someone sent us to the radio station. Of course, you're welcome to send us your experiences, your mail, your life story, whatever you feel is needed. But
if people are, if listeners are interested in this case, and it's a really significant one, if you go to the ACLU.org website, there's a lot of information about the Do Not Fly list. The program called CAPS and CAPS 2, which is the government wants to roll out instead of what they have now, which is going to be even worse, according to ACLU. There's a lot of good information on ACLU.org.
Absolutely. This listener wrote in to us about what's entitled Atlanta Immigration Fiasco. And if you've ever been through immigration, you know, we've been through it ourselves, Bernie, myself, a bunch of other people. But we're American citizens, so, you know, we don't have to really worry too much. Because
we're used to it.
We're used to it, and we know eventually they have to let us into the damn country. So it's not that, you know, you can almost have fun with it. You can almost just, you know, watch how bad it gets. But for people that can be sent back to a different country, it's not so much fun. And, of course, that's something to keep in mind for those people coming to the conference in July. Obviously, there's a lot of you know, anxiety attached to any kind of trip to this country. But hopefully people will get over that and, you know, try it anyway. Maybe tell their story when they get to the conference, because I'm sure we'll have a lot of good ones. This story here, just writing to inform about my recent trip to Atlanta. It took me no less than 5 hours from getting off the plane to leaving the airport. And that's not including the time taken to retrieve my luggage. And I was one of the lucky ones. The immigration police were downright nasty people, and they were sending people from visa waiver countries. Those are the countries where you don't have to show a visa to get into this country. I guess Western Europe and Japan and places like that, right? Canada.
Canada's its own category.
Yeah, Canada's its own category because they're right next door. But they were sending people from visa waiver countries to the back of a very long line. Do you know why? Because they filled in their forms in blue ink instead of black ink. Yeah, even though on the papers it doesn't even say it has to be filled out in black ink. They were sending them to the back of the line. I've seen immigration officers behave like that. Really, you know, treat people in a very disrespectful manner.
I have too.
And also sending them to the back of the line for writing too small, things like that. Any excuse to be nasty to someone, it seemed. I was standing in line for 5 hours and treated worse than cattle would be. I was threatened by no less than two immigration police that they would send me back home on the next flight if I did not stand still in line. I just sat on my ass for 9 hours and they expect me to stand still. After an 8 to 9 hour flight, no one should be treated this way. I almost told them to send me home on the next flight. I have a flight booked for the summer, and I'm flying via Philadelphia this time. I hope it isn't this bad in Philadelphia, or I will tell them to send me home and tell them I'll spend my money in another country instead. Well, if you come into the conference, please, you know, tell them something, but come to the conference, and, you know, your voice will be stronger that way.
Unfortunately, my experiences in Philadelphia have not been that much better, although, fortunately, I'm not a U.S. From another country, so I didn't have to deal with what this gentleman had to deal with, but I witnessed some pretty abusive tactics on by these customs people here in Philadelphia. But if he flies into Philly, he can just take a train up to New York, and that's one option.
Bernie, have you ever been treated like this in another country?
In Morocco, during the first Gulf War, I was not fighting in that war, but I had planned to be in Morocco before, you know, the saber rattling and George Bush the first decided to take action. And so I went anyway, and there were almost no tourists in Morocco. The 747 I flew on was almost empty on Royal Air Maroc. But a couple days after I got there, my host there, Ali, who lived in Morocco, he said, the police need to speak with you. Apparently the police called his house and said they wanted him to take me over there. And the police, it was this bizarre thing. The police interrogated me in Arabic, and
I didn't know you spoke Arabic.
My friend Ali had to translate everything. Oh. And he told me in the end, he said, really, they were really concerned really about my safety. They want to know what I was doing there. Why was an American coming to this rural town in Morocco called Beni Mellal? And they were really upset about the international implications of my being harmed, because there's a lot of anti-American sentiment in Morocco because the U.S. had dragged Morocco into that war, like the U.S. has dragged some other countries into this war. And I got out of there unscathed, and my friend who was Moroccan said really they were not trying to give me a hard time, although it seemed that way. And it's kind of weird being interrogated in the language you don't understand.
Yeah, well, I feel that way whenever I get interrogated here, because I just don't understand what they're talking about half the time. But but you got out of that okay, right?
Yeah, it was fine. And they shook my hand, and my friend Ali said, just tell them you're a student and you're here to learn. So that's what we did.
And then you came back here and you were promptly thrown in jail when you got back to this country.
Yeah, it wasn't that much longer before my freedom was lost in this country. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, your esteemed guest tonight is may be facing the same fate tomorrow. Let's hope not.
Let's hope not. But continuing on this subject first, before we get to Adrian, we also have this story concerning travelers from Western European nations and Japan who will be added in September to the list of foreign visitors who will be fingerprinted and photographed upon arrival in the U.S. That's right. According to the State Department, they're no longer going to be immune from that, where, certain countries, you have to have your fingerprint taken and you're photographed upon entering the country. Apparently, that's going to be expanded to Western Europeans as well. But not until September, so you can still come to the conference and not have to worry about
that. So it's a good time to come, because you can just kind of sneak in under the wire.
This may be the last opportunity you have to come into this country without having your vital statistics taken. Yes, Red Hat.
That's right.
Come on over.
As I understood it, they all have to comply with some new passport standard before they be able to come in without being fingerprinted again?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're making RFID passports
right.
Everywhere.
But this was until they come up with a new passport, right, that we can somehow...
Well, let's see. The rule...
yes.
Yeah, okay. The extension is... Extension? Okay.
The extension to those countries as being...
Oh, I see. Okay, the extension to those countries is designed to address security concerns stemming from a U.S. agreement last month to delay for 2 years a new passport requirement for visitors from 27 countries, mostly in Europe, who are allowed to enter the U.S. without visas. That rule is being delayed until December 2006, and it requires visitors from those 27 visa waiver countries to carry new passports that contain a machine-readable barcode and other information such as digital fingerprint identifying the holder. So, the new rule requiring fingerprint and photographs of U.S. visitors from the 27 visa waiver countries will take effect September 30th. The only countries whose visitors will not be subject to these requirements are Canada and Mexico.
Digital fingerprint, that sounds redundant.
Yeah, maybe it is. The Travel Industry Association of America, which last month praised the 2-year passport extension, has warned that the fingerprint rule could diminish business and leisure travel by alienating European and Japanese visitors. While we appreciate the rationale for the federal government's action, TIA is nonetheless greatly disappointed and very concerned about potential negative reactions in key inbound tourism markets in Western Europe, Japan, and other important visa waiver countries. No one's going to want to come here. No one's going to want to come to this country when these rules are implemented.
I predict there's going to be some serious impact on our tourism industry, and the airlines are going to be screaming bloody murder after this goes into effect, because they're not going to have as much money from customers.
Do you think the State Department cares?
I don't know.
Well, if they do, honestly, what I learned from my case with the Secret Service is the government really does care about bringing money in. That is an important goal, like one of the most important goals. And they really care about, industries that have influence with powerful political people. And the travel industry has lobbyists and powerful connections.
Inbound overseas travel to the U.S. has declined by 27% since the September 11th attacks. And this isn't going to help that any, I don't think. And I predict that once this goes into effect, it won't be very long before they implement this on American citizens as well. When you travel into this country, you will have to give your fingerprint.
And I just wonder, you know, will we get used to this kind of thing? Because we tend to get used to things.
Well,
you know?
You've already have to give your social security number on your passport so they can help trace the flow of money offshore.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for them to start taking swabs of people coming into our country because you know that these men are coming from overseas to take our women.
Yeah, the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, is examining the use of RFID-tagged airline boarding passes that could allow passenger tracking within airports. That's a proposal some privacy advocates call a potentially outrageous violation of civil liberties. Under the Registered Traveler Program, frequent flyers would provide the TSA with detailed personal information that would be correlated by a background check. Privacy advocates said they believe the RFID boarding pass would then serve as an automatic link to the Registered Traveler database. Details on how exactly this is going to work haven't been released yet, but you can only imagine how this kind of a system could be abused. Bernie, any ideas on ways that this system could be abused?
Well, the point you brought up earlier concerns me most, that it's not going to stop at digital fingerprint scans. It's going to become more and more intrusive, literally bodily intrusive. Biometric identifiers are going to have to be incorporated into identification systems, and you know it's all leading towards DNA. Everybody's, you know, government's going to have everybody's DNA eventually, and I, you know, that's going to happen in a few years because this stuff, mission creep that we have with these types of systems, just doesn't stop. You know, it keeps getting more intrusive over time, and it's sugarcoated for reasons like, oh, we have to do this to keep you safer or whatever. But, you know, these things don't stop. It's like a juggernaut.
It's in the interest of safety. I mean,
sure.
What wouldn't you give up for safety?
I don't feel safer in the slightest.
You don't feel safer?
No.
That doesn't sound very patriotic.
Well, that's one of my many problems.
RFID tagging, though, in airports, what exactly could they do with this? They would know where you are at all times? How much of a detection system can they actually have?
Well, if you have an RFID passport or anything else that's RFID tagged on your person, if there's an RFID detection unit or scanner that's within, you know, walking distance, maybe 10, 20 feet away from you, maybe longer depending on how they build it, it can basically ping your transponder in your passport and tell that you were there at that point in time. And there's no saying where these things are going to be put. No matter where you carry your passport or future driver's license that has RFID in it or whatever, or wrist bracelet in some people's cases, or on house arrest or ankle bracelets, whatever. Wherever you go, if some detection unit is placed at some place, these can be hidden. You don't know where they are. They can tell that where you are at any given time. It's kind of like EasyPass. That's the best analogy that most people are familiar with.
But EasyPass isn't a system where the government can send out a signal right now and know where my car is.
Yes. Oh, it's not true. That's not true. While they can't tell where you are, you know, RFID is the same way. They can't tell from a satellite that you're here or there.
Mm-hmm.
But if they have a detection unit that's, say, 20 feet away from where you pass,
right,
he could tell where you are.
Right,
and
but my car right now is in a hidden place. They would not know that unless there happened to be a detector nearby that could say just that.
There's no reason that EasyPass detection units couldn't be put at intersections, strategic intersections in New York City, for instance, and be able to tell that you went from here to here to here to here.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where they are. As far as we know, they're only in the toll booth. But I would bet that there are other places as well. And there's just no way of knowing because they're easily hidden.
Well, I mean, isn't there something we could build that would light up when these things are nearby?
Yes, it could be done.
Well, why don't we do it then?
Well, nobody's suggested it yet. But
I'm suggesting it now. I think that's a good project so that people know when the EasyPass system is being invoked, some kind of a device that beeps or lights up when you're near a sensor. And then the same thing with RFID tags. So that you know if you're being monitored or traced in some way. But my point was, in the airport, would they have the ability to say, where is passenger X, and immediately have an answer? Or would they just be able to say, passenger X was here at this particular point in time, and he could be any other place now?
If they put sensors all around the airport, they could tell where everybody is at any given point in time.
Yeah, if they wanted to spend the money, enough sensors could track you throughout the concourse to your baggage to the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps if you're a terrorist out on the tarmac. However, a smart terrorist will ditch his passport before getting anywhere near that.
Do you think?
Or wrap it in tinfoil.
Yeah, you could do that too. Tinfoil seems to be the answer to all these problems right now. But, wow, it's hard to imagine that this is what we're looking at right now. It's kind of like the camera system in Las Vegas. You ever go to Las Vegas in a casino, you will always, always have a camera on you no matter where you go. And as soon as you get out of sight of one camera, you'll notice another one is creeping around the corner and is getting you. So you're always on camera somewhere.
But let me tell you about that. Being a longtime poker player and things happen at the poker table and you want to have a camera to go back and determine, you know, who stole your chips or you know, what happened before the table was tipped over or
you
whatever.
You did it, Jim, didn't you?
Yeah, usually I do. But anyway, what happens is information overload. There are only so many cameras. Not all of them are taped.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them are watched. Lots of times I've been in a casino, something has happened, and nothing can be done because it wasn't taped or no one was watching it.
It's the Ceausescu syndrome where, you know, Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania taped everything, every phone call. And they had so many tapes of people talking, they did not have the staff to go through it all.
The control is not so much in the security office, although, of course, for the cashier's cage, they've got all that taped and the control is up there.
Mm-hmm.
But the control is within the minds of the people who know that there are cameras everywhere.
Amazing.
The big difference between the video monitoring and the telephone call recording and RFID. With RFID, it's a purely digital signal. It doesn't have to recognize someone's face, which is not a perfect technology, or recognize spoken words, which is not perfect technology, and both are very computer time-consuming, resource-consuming tasks. But RFID, they can just log all this data and anytime in the future play it back and say, you know, just do a search for Emmanuel Goldstein and see where he was at any given time, and it's right there. It's not like they have to cull through tons of tapes.
Mm-hmm.
It's instantaneous, digitally accessed data from a database.
Amazing.
Now, this is going to seem out of left field now because I've been waiting to say this for a couple minutes, but back to the EasyPass thing. Now, this might not have been true, but I heard someone told me that they received a ticket because they had been a detector on one side of like a bridge or the other side, and it had measured, you know, well, they passed by this detector at this time, they passed by the other one at this time, distance over time, that's how fast they were going.
They got a speeding ticket.
They were speeding.
You know, I've heard that they were going to do something like that,
right,
but you
okay.
have actually, Jeff, you're shaking your head.
No, I wasn't
viciously,
sure. Actually
so
happened.
It's a rumor, isn't it?
Well,
urban
legend. It was supposedly tested,
uh-huh.
and this may be part of the legend, but it didn't stick.
It didn't. What, the ticket didn't stick, or
right.
the technology didn't stick?
The technology sticks,
uh-huh.
but the ticket didn't.
Well, there's only one way to test this, and that's to get on the New Jersey Turnpike after the show, speed on down to Philadelphia at about 85, get off again, and see if you get a ticket in the mail.
I predict that bicycling is going to become a lot more popular.
Maybe.
And Bernie, one quick question.
Yeah.
Doesn't the Scout pick up the Easy Pass signal?
It may, and I was going to say that next time I go through a toll booth, I'm going to turn on my Optoelectronic Scout, which is a frequency counter we talked about on a previous show, to see if it picks that up. My guess is, though, that it's a digital signal, that we may need a digital Scout, which I don't own. It's a rather expensive piece of equipment, but that would almost certainly work for detecting the Easy Pass signal.
Digital Scout. Wow, okay. That's interesting. Well, so RFID detectors everywhere you go in the airport and... but you know, if you're in the airport and your passport has this, it's your passport or your boarding pass, you just hand it to somebody else. It seems like a very simple way to not be tracked, or you know, you throw it in the trash or something. If you're a terrorist, I imagine things like that won't be that hard to do.
Tinfoil.
Yeah,
and tinfoil, of course.
It will be nice to see Reynolds advertising that it's RFID grade.
You know, though, if someone just dropped off the map or stopped moving altogether, that would kind of be an indication that, you know, they did ditch their ticket or they did, try and mask
it.
That might be an
indication
that they're up to no good. So.
Right.
You want to hide your RFID tag. If you're on the LAM, obviously you want to stick it under the bumper of a random car or bus or something so that, you know, people go on a wild goose chase after you in the wrong direction.
Interesting. Len, you have something important to announce.
Well, just wanted to... The segue from the cameras was pretty good because actually tonight, for the first time you said?
I think so. If what you're going to say is what we said before, yes, probably
yeah,
is the first time.
I think we're going to have some visuals from the show. So if you want to go to jawga.com, if you have internet access.
We do. Here. Let's go there.
Then... Then we'll take some images. You'll have to refresh And
what's that URL again?
Thing that's like that. JAWGA.com.
You know what we can do later on is we move the camera close to that terminal. It'll be like looking in your own eye.
Yeah. Very exciting.
So, okay, we're trying to get that website up. So those are live pictures of the radio show here as we're speaking.
How are they getting there, Lynn?
Yeah, how are they getting there?
How are they getting there? They're getting there via a laptop with a Verizon Air card. Okay. And then they're getting FTP'd to the website.
JAWGA.com.
And then I'll snap some and
hey,
archive some
that's
of them.
That's me. Look at that. Wow. How about that's exciting. It doesn't take much to excite me.
We're anyway. Such simple people.
This person writes into our show, Dear Off the Hook, replying to the show on March 31st. When I visited Switzerland around 2 years ago, I saw a tank driving on the street right by the airport in the area where you rent cars. That's in response to Bernie's remarks last week about the tank that greeted his airplane.
Very weird.
It's, yeah. Switzerland has some tanks roaming
Swiss
around.
The Swiss are very big on national security. In a real sense, not in a fake sense like our government is. They just don't, you know, they're politically neutral. They don't mess with anybody else. They don't want to be messed with. And maybe that was just an intentional intimidation tactic to make sure that anybody landing in the plane who had thoughts of messing with them thought twice. Because I certainly thought twice.
You're already there, you know. You've already landed. I don't understand what the message is that they're sending to...
Well, I got the message.
Did it affect what you did later on? I mean,
no. It just affected how I felt. It's like, wow, these mm-hmm. people are really serious about their own security, and I felt, you know, I felt safe in a way. In other ways, I felt like, boy, if I were a terrorist, I would certainly think twice about pulling anything in this country.
It's not like the tank is going to be following you around everywhere you go in Switzerland, though.
Well, the Swiss are. The Swiss are very. There's a lot of other things the Swiss do to keep themselves safe, and they've managed to do that for a long time.
Like staying neutral for one.
Exactly.
That definitely helps. Okay, talking about things not being safe, mobile phones are in the hands of millions of people around the world. We all know that's not safe. But increasingly, it seems that they're also getting into the hands of terrorists. That's right. Somehow the terrorists are also getting their hands
How do they do that?
I don't know. They're very clever. But anyway, the bombers who targeted commuter trains on March 11th used the built-in alarm clock on a mobile phone to set off the explosives. Now, I've never used that feature on any of my phones, but apparently it's there.
I've used it.
In Jerusalem, it's believed that a call to a cell phone in a rucksack set off a bomb at Hebrew University in 2002. One of the Bali bombs in October 2002 had a cell phone attached, as did a car bomb which killed 12 people. Mobile phones, according to the Risk Advisory Group, are relatively cheap. You can acquire them in relatively large numbers. You can build a whole stack of them at one time and place them and set them off at your leisure. It means you can step away from some considerable distance, the other side of the world, in order to initiate the explosive device. Well, you know...
And there's some late-breaking news, Emmanuel. Today, in the Atlanta International Airport, allegedly a bomb was discovered in a backpack... With a grenade basically connected to a triggering device connected to a cell phone, and that was found in an Atlanta bathroom in an international airport today.
Really?
And a few years ago, I think it was probably around 93 or 94, the Israeli intelligence service, the Mossad, used a cell phone to blow up. This is a big.
That's right.
A Palestinian, military activist or whatever. It actually hid the explosives in the battery pack of the cell phone. It looked like a regular cell phone. And they just modified the battery pack. And they got somebody to switch the battery pack on this PLO guy's phone. And they basically called him and said goodbye and blew him up.
They actually said goodbye?
Well, they probably said something cute before they blew him up. I mean, it's just too good an opportunity to resist.
Well, I mean, was the action of picking up the phone, is that what made the explosive go off? Or was it
no, I imagine they could send some signal. They could send some signal, a tone or something, like a red box tone or something, and make it go boom.
So in addition to cell phones being used to trigger bombs, cell phones themselves could be bombs.
Sure. If an explosive device is hidden inside the battery pack and there's a little bit less battery is used,
mm-hmm.
It wouldn't have to be just... It could be just a cell phone, as far as you're concerned. I mean, there's enough explosives are powerful enough now, some of them, that you could just look like a cell phone. So You know, well, you could go through airport security, nobody would even know this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it just seems to me that, you know, triggering devices can be almost anything that has a clock in them.
And a pager.
Yeah, a pager, certainly. And I just think this might be used to limit people's right to use phones. For instance, at the convention later this year, I am certain, and this is my prediction, that they are going to jam all cell phones around Madison Square Garden throughout the convention, meaning that you won't be able to communicate with anybody if you happen to be there, unless, of course, you're with the authorities.
The reporters would kill the people who did that, so I don't know.
Well, maybe they'd have to work something out with the government to be allowed to communicate. I don't know. But they're talking about using cell phone jammers. Now, cell phone jammers are illegal to have in this country. Basically, they're the size of a phone. They can block cell phone signals in a 20-foot radius. Larger devices can block signals reaching an entire building.
They demonstrated one at H2K2.
Well, it was illegal then because you're not allowed to have them in this country and you're not allowed to have them in England. They say the right to make a call reigns supreme. Although, you know, it's my dream to drive down Wall Street if I could still do that and just watch people saying, hello, hello, and not being able to reach their the other side. But it wouldn't be right. It would be wrong. But it would be funny. Michael Minaj of Global Gadget said, in the UK, as in most other nations, they are illegal because you are interfering with somebody else's right to use a mobile telephone. Through these aerials, you are broadcasting a signal on a wavelength for which you do not have a license. But governments are using similar technology. It's widely reported a radio jammer inside the car of Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf stopped an attempt to assassinate him last December. A bunch of us heard about that. And, yeah, it's they jammed the signal that apparently was going to be triggered by a cell phone. It's expected more high-profile people will use the technology in the future. I guess, you know, every time the president is in town, maybe they'll jam all cell phone calls around where he is.
There actually is a security measure the Secret Service and the White House Communications Agency does. There's a van. Have you ever seen the president's motorcade?
Mm-hmm.
If you look behind his limousine, and there's always two. There's one that's the real one and one's the fake one. And they never, you know, you can't tell which one is which. But if you look behind one of them, there's a van, or like a big SUV. It's really a van with tons of antennas on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really run by the White House Communications Agency, and there's jamming equipment on that van to jam to monitor all the radio signals around and to jam them. There's a good book called Inside the White House, or I think it's Inside the Secret Service or Inside the White House. I think it's Inside the White House by Ronald Kessler, K-E-S-S-L-E-R. It describes the White House Communications Agency's van and its radio signal jamming tactics that it uses wherever the president goes in the world.
Wow. So even in a different country with totally different frequencies, that van will follow him.
They're always listening and always jamming. And I took a GPS unit to a President Clinton rally here in Philadelphia back in 97. And my GPS unit failed to receive the signal when the president was speaking. And after he left, a few hours later, it worked fine. It worked fine before, and it worked fine when he left. So I can only conclude that GPS signals were being jammed because I guess you could put one on a missile or a model airplane with an explosive on it and use GPS to guide.
Yeah, the day a missile comes out of the sky and hits the president, that's when I'll say, okay, yeah, you know what? We are living in dangerous times, and maybe we should have increased security. But
plan for everything.
Yeah. Now, you say there's two limousines. There's a fake limousine and a real limousine every time the president travels?
Typically.
Couldn't you just get twice as many attackers?
Yep.
Is there a fake president in that limousine, too? Or
I think there's a fake president now. But
yeah. Yeah, well, that goes without saying.
It's just cloth upholstery instead of the leather.
Uh-huh.
But Bernie mentioned a moment ago about the fact that a cell phone with explosives might go through the airline detection, and I thought they had sniffers going on all this new equipment as well.
Only if you're chosen to be sniffed. I've been sniffed just once or twice.
I watched it one time, I remember.
Yeah, you were there watching me being sniffed. And you know, they take your stuff and they put it through. They actually take this wand with a cloth swab on the end of it, and they dab it all around the inside and the outside of your bags, and they take the cloth out of the swab and they put it in the special detection equipment that electronically sniffs for, you know, explosive molecules. And fortunately, it came up zilch with me.
Yeah. The other thing I'm wondering is what is the ratio of battery to explosive for a cell phone anyway?
3-1.
It is 3-1. Okay,
you have to ask the Mossad. They're experts in that department.
Well, just to finish up on this story, apparently the U.S. Department of Defense is also in on this. They have a program called Wolfpack. That basically denies the enemy the use of all radio communications, including mobile phones, on the battlefield. So I'm sure you'll be seeing that used a lot in Iraq in weeks to come. But it's something to keep an eye on here as well, to see when signals are being jammed. I'd like to know more about that if when the president is around, that GPS signals are blocked. So let's definitely keep an eye on that. Let me read this letter, and then we'll get to some more material here. Again, we are on for 2 hours tonight, Off the Hook, a special expanded edition. This person writes in, there's a law that's going for the first reading in the Canadian Senate called the Canadian Public Security Act. It's dreadfully similar to the U.S. Patriot Act. Our Prime Minister, Paul Martin, who above all else wants to be George W. Bush's friend, he even said that, and our Heritage Minister, we don't have a Heritage Minister, do we? I guess not, has stated that they plan to fix the hole in Canadian copyright law that allows sharing of files. We reported on this last week. I'm finding it somewhat difficult and extremely time-consuming to find information on events like this happening in Canada compared to the relative ease of finding information in the U.S. My website is now posting any information I can find on the issue. The URL is http://www.act6.org/OZZ, and my email is listed there for people to send information, so please post information there, signed Sean. And Sean, thanks for taking the interest, and let us know what happens up there. I know it's easy for things to get passed when people don't know anything about them, so it's important to be educated. All right, with that, I'd like to get to our special guest this week, who's been waiting patiently, Adrian Limo. Welcome to New York.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sorry it has to be on these circumstances that you're here. You're being sentenced in federal court tomorrow for crimes involving the New York Times, which we talked about on this program a few months ago. Can you tell us what exactly they involved?
I'm being sentenced for my unauthorized access to the New York Times internal network, to which I pled guilty in early January.
Mm-hmm.
I gained access to their network, their information resources, and accounts of theirs, which I accessed without authorization and in some instances misused. I contacted the Times by way of a reporter shortly after that intrusion and notified them of their vulnerabilities, and they elected to press charges, as is their right.
Mm-hmm.
And my sentencing is coming up on those matters tomorrow.
So now, this access allowed you to see what exactly?
As described in the complaint, the access included information regarding some of their contributors to their op-ed page, which is generally a pretty diverse list, including former presidents, people tied to the UN, actors who are relatively well known. I certainly don't want to drag their names out again because they've probably had enough of it. But
so basically, they had a database online through their website that had these people's private information just there.
In many cases, including social security numbers and home telephone numbers and such.
And how were you able to find this?
All of the access in question took place through a web browser.
Uh-huh. And did you have to crack some kind of a code to figure out how to get in?
Well, I don't want to get into it too much, since it's really all in the past, and what I'm trying to do is move forward. But essentially, it all happened through a web browser and a use of an open proxy. It was nothing terribly sophisticated. In retrospect, I probably wasn't such a hot idea, but there was nothing that was complicated about the access. There was no exceptional security going on. They had a lot of problems, and for that matter, may still.
Uh-huh. I just find it odd that, instead of just fixing the problem, closing the hole, and moving on, that they would want to drag this out and, put somebody through torture like they're putting you through, having to come all the way to New York to face trial and then to face sentencing and all that kind of a thing. I mean, you've been involved in security for quite some time. You've alerted lots of companies to security holes, and I imagine quite a few of them have been very happy you've done that.
I imagine that it seems reasonable to them. It's easy to be angry about intrusion, and really, I can't blame them. To them, I'm just another anonymous name, another intruder. They don't tie a face to it. They have no reason to know or care that I have a family or how this affects them or anything like that. It's just a person, and it's just an intrusion to be dealt with. And on that level, I think I'm guilty of roughly the same thing, and that It's easy to disregard the time that administrators have to put in to fix these sorts of things. Mind you, they probably could have fixed them earlier on, and none of this would have ever happened.
Right, and they could have been there in the first place, so that people wouldn't be able to get in. I mean, I just find it amazing that through the web you can access this information that's sitting there. It's private information; it shouldn't be on the internet at all. I don't see any reason for it to be. And obviously, you don't want to say this kind of a thing, but I want to say that I think they should be held accountable for this. They're the ones that violated these people's privacy because they had that information out there where people could find it. You know, unfortunately, they're blaming the messenger for the message, and I just think that's sad.
Well, I do think that there are some lines that I stepped over in my access, mm-hmm. and that's why I pled, and that's why I'm stepping up to take whatever sentence is handed down. I'm obviously hoping for the best.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be reasonable, not like, the case of Bernie or the case of Kevin. I mean, you know, in Kevin's case in particular, he admitted he did something wrong, that's an important admission to make. But certainly the sentence that he received as a result of what he did wrong, 5 years in prison and all this time on probation, and not to even mention the time when he was trying to escape it all, for what actually happened, just strikes me as absurd and completely out of proportion with reality.
I think that computer crime law, computer crime prosecutions, and really internet culture as a whole are evolving entities, and I think that situations like Kevin's and those like him really contribute to the evolution of it. I think that there's room for people to learn from mistakes of the past, and I think that in some ways, although there are many parts of it that I wish hadn't happened, and it's certainly been a traumatic experience for me and those around me, I think that they've taken some of the lessons from those cases and learned that there are some things that they should take into account that they shouldn't do. And I mm-hmm. like to hope that the circumstances of this case will similarly contribute to the evolution of the process in the future.
What were the actual charges that that they filed against you?
I was originally charged with multiple counts. At the plea, the charges were reduced to one count of unauthorized access to the New York Times Network, which encompassed my access to the Times Network, to informational services to which the Times subscribed, and one section of what's called relevant conduct, which involved access to a Microsoft customer database containing information on everybody who had ever bought a product directly from Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And for those, the amalgamated damages were approximately $65,000, which is something that I will have to pay back most likely. And I'd like to think that this will be an educational experience of sorts. I'm looking at it as sort of an extended student loan. I think that really all parties involved can come away better from this.
I have to say, you have an amazingly positive outlook on these kinds. I'd be very bitter myself.
I think that really everybody involved is doing what they feel is right. The Times felt that they had assets to defend, and that's their right. The agent felt that she had law to uphold, and that's certainly her duty. And I, for my part, at this point in time, have lessons that I think I've learned and a future to look to, and I really want to put this behind me to the degree possible. And which isn't to say that I support criminalizing curiosity, not in the least, and that's really why I'm going into journalism, because I believe that that's a venue where curiosity can make a difference, where I can do things involving curiosity, involving seeing things differently, involving wanting to know more about the world around me, and do them positively in a way that's legitimate, in a way that allows me to make meaningful change.
Mm-hmm. Adrian?
Go ahead.
I have a question for you. This is Bernie in Philadelphia. I understand you were charged under both the U.S. Criminal Code, which is Title 18, Section 1029 and 1030. Is that correct?
That is correct.
What I was also charged under Section 1029 for possession of hardware software for the that could be used for the unauthorized used for modifying a piece of telecommunications equipment for the unauthorized access to telecommunications services. What part of Section 1029 specifically were you charged with violating?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm under the impression that it had to do with unauthorized possession of access devices. In this case, passwords for a informational service, LexisNexis, to which the New York Times subscribed.
So you were charged with possessing passwords that you shouldn't have had?
That's correct.
Okay, that's what I was trying to find out. What part of 1029 were you charged with? And so just the possession of a password, not necessarily the use of it, is a criminal offense, right?
Again, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not sure exactly how that was charged. In this case, I did make use of the passwords, and I confessed to that in my plea allocution.
I have another question about the LexisNexis account that you allegedly used to look up legal information and news information. Was that a flat rate account that New York Times had that you were charged with using?
You know, I don't know. I don't have any formal information in that regard. I have reason to believe that it was flat rate, but again, it's not something that I intend to nitpick about. I want to take responsibility for this,
sure.
And I want to put it behind me.
Right.
I appreciate you can't be completely frank, although you have to say you are being frank, and I appreciate the fact you're getting sentenced tomorrow, and you have to choose your words very carefully because I'm sure every word you were saying tonight is being scrutinized, and it takes a lot of courage to...
I like to think that I'd say the same things that I'm saying now if this were happening 2 days later. I'm not one to put on different faces for different circumstances.
I'm sure.
Well, I mean, I'd like to say just to Bernie that, along those lines, if something is an unlimited account, obviously it didn't cost anything if somebody made use of it, if it wasn't charged, per usage or whatever. But we don't know for sure if that was the case. But one has to suspect that a company like the New York Times would have some kind of arrangement like that.
Yeah, I think what Bernie's getting at is we're kind of curious how they computed this $65,000 figure. There's certainly been a history of companies just kind of inventing figures. You know, we're caused $3 million worth of damage because whatever reason. And a lot of times the government will not take a case if, someone only caused $50 worth of damage or no monetary damage at all. So they invent these large numbers, and I'm wondering if you have any idea how they came up with this number.
Well, I know that it's the sum of the various parts of the allegations to which I confessed, and that part of it comes from LexisNexis, part of it comes from the New York Times, and part of it comes from Microsoft. As to the precise calculations, I don't know, and I sort of made a decision early on that this was something that I could nitpick about, or it's something that, once they got it down to a reasonable figure, because the original figure just didn't strike me as reasonable. It was in the neighborhood of $300,000 just for LexisNexis searches. And, I just didn't believe that was true. But in the numbers that we've stipulated, too, I think that's reasonable, and I'm not going to nitpick at it. I
appreciate that. I just think it's important to point out, for the sake of listeners, who hears something like that somebody caused, $100,000 of damage, just what exactly they're talking about when they say that and how that could be interpreted or misinterpreted.
It could be analogized to someone borrowing your cell phone when you had unlimited nights and weekends for long distance, and they made a bunch of long distance calls, and they gave it back to you, and you didn't give them permission to make long-distance calls, even though it didn't cost you a dime or even a penny for them to make those calls. That might be a similar analogy. Well, apparently the New York Times didn't give Adrian permission.
Right.
There's a very good chance that they had a flat... I mean, of all news entities, you would think the New York Times would have a flat-rate account for LexisNexis access, and it seemed astounding to me that they wouldn't. And how they came up with this dollar figure is really intriguing, because it reminds me of cases like Kevin Mitnick's case, where these numbers are just picked out of a hat.
Mm-hmm.
They remember the old 911
911 document. What did they say that was worth?
$75,000, tens of thousands of dollars.
It seemed like a large amount at the time. Now, of course, they're going crazy. Oh, $100 million now. And we saw them, we caught them at this with the Kevin Mitnick case, where they were saying things were worth a lot of money that they were giving away for free. And it was obvious that the feds were simply trying to get them to come up with the largest number possible so that the case would stick. And in the end, in the Kevin Mitnick case, what was he finally ordered to pay? I think $3,000 was the total amount. And I think everybody came away from that realizing that it was really nonsense, that there was no harm caused. That, yeah,
originally
it
was in the millions.
It was in the hundreds of millions, I believe.
Yeah, it was.
And obviously, to have somebody intrude on your computer system without permission is wrong. And Adrian certainly understands that. Kevin understands that. But what I don't understand, and I think a lot of other people don't understand, is how you can go after somebody and make their lives so miserable. Just to prove this point that has already been understood.
The ironic thing in all this is because these Section 1029 that Adrian is being charged with violating falls under the federal fraud statutes. And the what I find ritually ironic about all this is the dollar estimates that are being thrown around for the damage that he allegedly caused, I think, are, because they seem to be lacking in factual basis, are fraudulent in and of themselves. But, I mean, it's just ironic, and we may never be able to prove that, but it seems to be what's happening.
Yeah, Bernie, in your case, were such things done very often as far as exaggerating the amount of something or just...
No, my case was rather unique in that there was never even any allegation or charge that I had accessed anything or caused, you know, one dime's worth of damage or no dollar figures were mentioned. In fact, in the pre-sentence investigation report, which will be read at Adrian's sentencing tomorrow, in my case, the pre-sentence investigation report stated, and I'm quoting from it here, there were no victims in the offense, end quote. Yet, I was charged with just the mere possession of hardware software that could have been misused, landed me with a conviction. Now, we all know it wasn't really about that. There's a whole long story behind it. But the bottom line is, they didn't actually stoop to coming up with fictitious dollar amounts, although it was insinuated that if I didn't plead guilty, that when it went to trial, they would, and if I were found guilty, which I certainly would have, because I never contested the fact that I possessed this hardware and software. The hardware you could buy any Radio Shack, and the software was being freely given away by me. Sorry, I lost my track. Train of thought.
Well, okay.
What was your question again?
Well,
the dollar amount.
Yeah, they were exaggerated.
Yeah, well, what they said is if I was found guilty, then at the sentencing stage, which is not an evidentiary proceeding, mm-hmm. at the sentencing stage, they could estimate that the numbers of pieces, the software that I gave out, and the parts that I distributed that you could buy at any Radio Shack store could have been misused to commit this many dollars amount in fraud, which would have significantly increased the number of years that I was spent behind bars. And they made that very clear, that if I didn't plead guilty, at the sentencing stage where they don't have to prove a thing, they would come up with these estimates, which they're allowed to do. So I saw the writing on the wall and realized that this wasn't going to go my way. So in Adrian's case, I'm sure there is similar insinuations that they don't have, at the sentencing stage, if you go to trial in a federal case and you're found guilty, they throw everything at you afterwards and don't have to prove anything. So the dollar amounts, which they can come up with later, can be really fictitious, and they don't have to show any basis in fact to these dollar amounts. And the sentencing is based on the dollar amount. So it's really not set up fairly, in my opinion.
Well, they have all the resources. As you mentioned in Freedom Downtime, they have everything, and they're going to use all these resources. Yeah. You don't have very much at all, so obviously it's
Adrian was actually somewhat fortunate, although everybody thinks, you know, he's going through hell, and I sympathize with him. At least he had the benefit of being out in a free state, not behind bars. Mm-hmm. To work on his own defense, which is very difficult to do.
Yes.
When you're locked up. And when he is sentenced tomorrow, I'm certainly hoping he's not going to be incarcerated, but regardless of his sentence, he will have a day to look forward to. In Kevin's case and in mine's case, neither of us knew. We were both locked up from the get-go, had no time to plan a defense or no way to plan or strategize a defense outside of prison walls, and it's very difficult to do when you're locked up. You don't have access to the phone in a normal way. You don't have access to internet. You don't have access to people. You don't have access to books that you would normally on the outside.
But one thing you do have is a lot of time, and I notice a lot of people behind bars turn into real legal experts, knowing, you know, every law that applies to them and how it's not exactly true, how they're being prosecuted. And I'm quite impressed sometimes reading some of the briefs that are filed by these people.
It's astounding. But if you have access to Lexis, which is the big Mead Data Central legal database, which the feds have, that's a huge, in a war of attrition, that's a huge advantage, being able to access, you know, in all case law ever written at your fingertips with just a keystroke, as opposed to a bunch of musty volumes on a shelf.
Unless you're using the New York Times account, in which case it's not an advantage at all. Kind of ironic there. Another thing that I think is ironic is that Adrian is interested in pursuing journalism, which, you know, I've often said that any good journalist is also a good hacker. And it's too bad that the Times didn't realize that. At least, you know, the legal arm of the Times, I guess, is not really the same as the reporter part of the Times.
Well, the Times has remarkably few good journalists, but we'll talk about that another day.
Okay, you're on. We're talking with Adrian Lamo, who's live in our studio on the eve of his sentencing. And in case you're worried that you won't be able to make a phone call, fret not, because we're on for an extra hour tonight. And our phone number is 212-209-2900. So if you want to ask any questions, but feel free to, you know, ask whatever you want. But I imagine there are some things, Adrian, that you can't talk about. And please respect that.
Is it a stretch, Emmanuel, do you think, to suspect that journalists that work for the New York Times have at one time or another, somewhere down the road, done something that might not have been unethical to get information to research a case?
Oh, I've witnessed it firsthand. I'm not going to name names, but yeah, journalists do that kind of thing all the time.
Okay, so is this a case of the pot calling the kettle black, or what?
Again, you know, it's not the journalists that are taking Adrian to court. I imagine most journalists would understand what it is that...
Yes, but the Times is...
The Times is a corporation out to make money and protect their shareholders,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that's, you know, the fact that they publish a newspaper really is incidental, you know. I don't know, that's just my my view of the way things are.
Yeah, I got a quick question.
Yes.
When this first broke, I deal with high school kids all day long, and I was sharing the story, and they used a moniker for you. What do you call yourself? Well, how do you look at... Well, how would you describe yourself?
I tend to not really describe myself. There are a lot of labels and a lot of terms that have been thrown out around there, but I don't really adopt any of them in that I don't necessarily feel that what I do is easily categorizable. For me, it's not strictly about technology. It's more about a way of looking at the world and looking at life, and as I've said before, is ultimately closer to being about religion for me than it is about technology.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Okay. Again, you're listening to WBAI in New York. If you're tuning in for the Personal Computer Show, actually, you'll be tuning in 2 minutes, but I'll make this announcement again. They are not on tonight, unfortunately. They will be back next week, and we're on for an extra hour. Again, our phone number is 212-209-2900, and we're with Adrian Lamo, who is here from California, and hopefully you'll get to use that return plane ticket that you have. If not, you might be a guest of some institution for a while. It must be hard. I mean, how does it feel being in a foreign city and not knowing if you're going to be going back?
It's nerve-wracking, and it's been a nerve-wracking process, but in a sense, I'm looking forward to tomorrow in that it'll take a weight of uncertainty off my shoulders. I've spent the better part of the last 6 months not having any idea of what the future would hold for me, and after tomorrow, it will all be over except for doing my time in whatever form it takes. And that's a relief. I won't have to worry about how it's going to play out. It'll be done with. And for me, I think that will be a positive thing. As much as something positive can come out of this experience, I look forward to moving on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take some phone calls. 212-209-2900. And good evening. You're on the air.
Hey, Emmanuel. How's it going?
How you doing? Where are you calling from?
California.
California. Okay, what's on your mind?
I was curious, a few questions, especially one for Bernie. What's about, you guys actually brought up before about the cell phone blockers. I was curious, is there anything for the wireless range, either 2.4 or 5.4, I believe it is, that does the same thing? Essentially, it would stop people from using wireless internet in a certain area?
Yeah, it's actually commonly available. It's called a microwave oven.
Is there anything handheld that would do that?
Because
I know both microwaves and fluorescent lighting can stop 2.4.
Well, you can. I mean, there are applications. There's malicious software out there, written that's out there that just attacks wireless networks and uses up all the DHCP addresses, for instance, gobbles them all up. So if you're you know, DHCP Wi-Fi site, you know. They're all gobbled up, and you don't have any to use. So that's one thing. But just from an RF standpoint, which is what you asked, a simple $50 microwave oven, if it's a if the door is taken off and it's turned on and you jumper the interlock switch, that can knock out all the 2.4 gigahertz cordless phones and wireless networks within probably a mile, depending on which direction it's pointed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is there anything that would be handheld that you could create that would, say, generate white noise or something to that effect? Would that work?
It could be done. There's no reason that couldn't. RF is funny how it behaves. The radio signals, how they bounce around and so forth. I wouldn't want to be near a microwave oven with this door open, though.
I was going to say, Bernie, doesn't it also effectively work for birth control?
Well, if you point it up at the sky, you can and you could actually hit a duck with it, and it'd be cooked before it lands.
The other thing that's interesting is that those frequencies that are used for 802.11 are secondarily allocated to ham radio, as you know. And there was a group in Texas who essentially shut down Wi-Fi within about a 3-mile radius because it was interfering with their TV transmitter that they had on the air for about 10 years.
And there was no legal problem with them doing that either because they were licensed.
They're primary. Primary, and 802.11 is Part 15, which means that it has to accept any harmful interference. The only people, actually I say primary, they're secondary. Of course, the U.S. government is primary on 2.4.
Okay, thanks for that question. Lynn, also...